The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And I'm back at Domaine Caylus with Brooke Husband, the assistant winemaker with Caylus and with Mason Vineyard. Brooke, thanks so much for being part of the podcast today.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited.
I sent you some of the questions. Let's start here. As we record this, it's November 13th. What's November at this time of year? What is it like for winemakers?
It's crazy. We're all tired. I guess it depends on if you're doing Bordeaux. And of course, Kelly and I make lots of Bordeaux. We just finished processing. It was a later season and we're maybe going to catch up on some sleep in about a week or so.
How much sleep did you get last night? When did you go to bed?
I went to bed at 9 o'clock.
Ooh, but when did you wake up?
5:30.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay. So that's not bad. But yeah, I'm always curious. Just now, people would think that now's the light time. All the harvest is done, so you guys get to relax. But that's not the case, is it?
No, not at all. This is the time of year where everyone's saying like, you can come out now because harvest is over. It's like, well, the harvesting is over, but now we've got all the wine in tank, mm-hmm. got all the extractions, and we have to take care of all the wines. And we make close to 40 wines now. With myself and Kelly. So it's stress, no sleep.
What are the next couple of weeks going to be like?
So mostly we're just tending to the wines. All the reds are fermenting now. As of today, I think they're all starting wild fermentation. So it's spontaneous and you really have to watch, tasting 3 times a day. Sometimes you have to come in super late at night to do an extra punch down because the heat's up.
Right.
And so we want to make sure we get it. Yes, right. Exactly. Yeah.
Wild fermentation. I want to learn about your journey and stuff, but one thing I notice about a lot of the wines you make, and you and Kelly, you guys very much embrace the idea of wild fermentation. For people that don't know what that means, I don't know if you just sort of explain it to everyone.
What you can do you can inoculate a wine for fermentation. So basically, you're getting a commercial yeast product you can get off the shelf. It tells you what kind of flavors you're going to get. And that's great. And a lot of wineries choose to do that because they want a consistent product.
Right.
For us, we like the wild fermentation. We feel like it shows the terroir of the vineyards better and more interesting flavors, more complex. It's not the same year after year. And that's what we're looking for.
And it's funny, on one level, what you're doing, it's not safe at all because you're no longer in control. But on the other level, to make great wine, you almost... Consistency is the enemy of creativity, I would imagine, when it comes to making wine.
Yeah, for sure. I know that a lot of winemakers who choose to use a yeast to inoculate, they still have their smaller fermentations
right.
that they like to experiment on. But at the end of the day, that gets blended into the large blend. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't make a difference because usually it's larger skews. Yeah, we definitely have to try and be in control, but also you need to kind of let go and say, like, this is the way it is. You just have to keep it as safe and healthy as possible. You're constantly watching it. Just based off experience, you know when you need to intervene and do certain things to the wine, like give it, a Fermate add or any type of nutrition that it needs.
When do you get to relax? When do you get to relax?
So that's a tough question because for winemaking, the way that Kelly and I make wines, we're currently aging the 2022s. We're fermenting the 2023s. So when we can relax with the 2023s is when they're sulfured and they're completed fermentation. They're totally dry because we're not making any sweet wines here. So we have to wait until they're dry, which takes a long time. Then we stress about the 22s again, because now we have to put them to bottle. It's kind of this summer we can kind of relax because then there's less work to do. Bottling's done,
right.
Prepping for harvest. I would say this summer for me, but I'm not so much in the vineyard as other winemakers. So that's when I relax, but poor Kelly,
Yeah, yeah. Poor Kelly, yeah, she's the busiest person I know.
Yeah.
Do you have any vacations planned?
Kelly and I usually take 2 weeks at Christmas. Mm-hmm. So we were kind of talking about that, but that could, if we still have ferments, that changes things.
Are you going to be staring at all the juice at all the tanks going, hey, do your job. I want to go get a tan.
Yeah, yeah, totally. It's yeah. So we're at the mercy of the ferments right now. But I would get a 2-week vacation again in the summer. Mm-hmm. Usually I do that. And that's pretty like for sure. I'm gonna get that. Christmas is kind of.
When was the last time you booked an airline ticket months in advance?
I don't know. Months, like 2 months, maybe.
Sure, we'll go 2 months.
I booked. I went to Nashville last mm-hmm. year, and mm-hmm. so that was maybe 2 months in advance.
Okay.
Yeah, it was kind of like okay, it's a cheap flight. I think I can do it, and then talked to Kelly, and we were like, okay, we can do it.
How long did you June. Go? By the way, how long was that Nashville trip for?
4 days.
4 days. Look at you. Just totally shirking your responsibilities. we'll go back. I want to go back for you for a second. Actually, for a lot, not for a second. Mm-hmm. Niagara College Winery, the viticulture program. Would you recommend for people that are looking to get into wine? Like, was it a good experience? Because there's always the debate of going to school versus don't go to school. Just try to get hands-on experience. I'm wondering how the experience was for you.
So I loved my experience at the college. It did a lot for me. And I would recommend that program to everyone who wants to be in wine. And I do think it's important to go to school. I think that where I struggled with it is that I hadn't done a harvest before. If you're interested in it, try to get your hands dirty before, because I really didn't have any idea what it was like. And then you're in school, you're learning, and it would just be so much easier to have had a visual of what these things looked like. And then they tell you it's going to be really hard. It's going to be tough, no sleep, lots of hard work. And so then you're nervous about it because there's all this hype and there's like two people in the class that have done it and they're like, oh yeah, it's terrible.
By the way, those people. Oh yeah, there I was, 2018, Okanagan, hail hit. And they get to be the grizzled vets.
Mm-hmm, yeah, and I think though, if you were to not go to school, I think you kind of get stuck in the, okay, I've worked 8 harvests and I've been an intern. You're used to getting work orders and you're not really thinking about, okay, why am I doing this work order? Why am I doing this today? And why did they pick? And I think that if you go to school, then you can ask the questions. If you want to be a winemaker, you should probably go to school, I think.
What was your first harvest like? What do you remember about it?
It was tough.
And what year was it? Sorry to interrupt.
2017 mm-hmm. At Domaine Cayluz. And it was tough, but I chose Domaine Cayluz because I wanted to work with Kelly. I heard that it was the hardest place to work at, and wild fermented Pinot Noir, you're crazy if you do it. I love a challenge, and that was kind of why I chose to come to Domaine Cayluz. I think that the toughest part for me was that I was so new, and I'm very competitive with myself, and I wanted to be better. Mm-hmm. And learning how to like flip barrels and do certain things. You want to impress the winemaker, but you're fumbling with your clamps, and that was tough, but that comes with experience. And the more clamps you put on, the better you get at it. And the more barrels you flip, your muscle memory is better. You're not hurting your back as much if you do it right. It was difficult in that sense, but I really loved learning about Pinot Noir, and Kelly was great about, if I asked questions, she was answering them, and she believed in me, which was important. I needed that because I was going into it not as confident as I am now, of course. So,
I mean, again, you're younger, and as you said, getting into the business, and how much research had you done on Cayluz and on Kelly Mason?
I did. I tried the wines, and I knew of Kelly. At that time, it was also Thomas Batchelder was here. Mm-hmm. I knew of him.
Yep.
I tried once I decided I wanted to go to Cayluz. I wanted to look more into wild fermentation and kind of what that would look like. And I was interested in that. And that was something that at the college we didn't talk so much about. I think they're doing a better job now because more of Niagara is doing wild ferment. But of course, they've got, you know, let's say 40 students. They're not going to let people go crazy and do wild ferments all the time, because then that's on them now to help fix things that are really tough to catch. That was kind of where I was at.
You also worked in Okanagan at Black Hills. What is that experience like? And also, I'm always curious about this, is what are the biggest differences about being in the vineyards in Niagara versus Okanagan?
The experience was great. We had a full female intern team, and we all had the exact same sense of humor and taste in music, and that's really important. We had so much fun.
What was the music being played?
Lots of throwbacks. And like we had a One Hit Wonders playlist. That was really fun because it's just different. And you're like, oh yeah, this song's great. And then you look at this person who sings it and you're like, I don't have any idea. I would never have guessed that.
Yeah.
And Elaine Vickers was the winemaker. And she was so fun and she's very technical and she loves making Chardonnay. And so it was cool to learn from her a little bit about that. The differences, there's massive differences between Okanagan and Niagara. So I mean, the main one is that we have an escarpment we call a mountain, and they have real mountains.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in that sense, the entire Okanagan Valley is, the topography is different, and they have, like, you know, a desert to an area that does so well with Pinot and Chard because it's a little bit cooler. Kelowna is kind of like the Niagara on the lake, where it's like more, I don't want to say commercial necessarily. It's just like more, that's like where people go. And yeah, that's like the buses.
The hub for wine tourism, things like that. And
yeah,
and also you kind of need that commercial space because that also helps to raise the profile and gets more people buying wine. And
it's
then they
so
take
important.
It, they take it back to their corner of the world. And, and hopefully then more people come in later.
Yeah. Yeah. So that, I think that just like the vineyards of viticulture is so different. It's very interesting. I think what was kind of an interesting difference is like here I feel like we're very, very supportive of like, you know, try this winery in Niagara on the Lake or the Bench. And not the winemakers or people in production by any means, but I found the customers were very reluctant about Ontario wine. And they called it Ontarible. And I was shocked.
And that was in BC.
In BC, yeah.
But they're so much more. It's weird. They're so much more supportive of theirs, but
yes,
but they viewed on
their own.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
And I think honestly, the only problem is that there's not enough Ontario wine there, and that's a big problem. And I can't blame them for thinking that because in comparison, if they've never been to Ontario, they've never had Ontario wine. Of course, they think that their area is so much better because
I mean.
If you put down all the reasons on a piece of paper, technically their place is better for growing wine. But the challenges that we have here, every vintage is different. We're making unique wines, cool climate. They have the fires and we have the humidity. Mm-hmm. It's very different. So I would encourage more of them to try and come this way to explore more Canadian wines for sure.
Also, it'd be nice if Ontarians supported Ontario the way people in BC support BC when it comes to
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like, I don't want them to say that, but in the same sense, I'm like, wow, they have so much pride for that land and that's great. And they're doing a really great job. I think globally, people probably know more about BC wines than Ontario wines. And it's just completely different. Like they can get their bricks up so much higher than we can in some years. So, but they have the same struggles as us. Like in 2022, we suffered with low yields, and now 2023, they're suffering with low yields. So it seems to be like we're having more parallels, which is good. And we can talk to winemakers and say like, what are you doing with this? And that's exciting.
What made you want to get into it? I realized I passed over all the stuff from Niagara College. We talked about that. Then I got into Okanagan, but I want to circle back. What made you want to get into wine?
So I originally went to Niagara College for culinary, and I loved that. I really, really loved it. And I really loved going to Niagara College and the Niagara on the Lake campus. I realized that culinary wasn't for me. It's something that I didn't want to hate. I didn't want to make that my job, but it was totally worth it because now I'm a good cook. But I knew I wanted to go back to Niagara College, and I was starting to get into wine slowly. And I saw the winery and viticulture program. I thought that could be interesting. And I could maybe pair that with my culinary certificate that I got. So that's kind of why I got into it. Originally thinking maybe I'd go the SOM route. And then I did a harvest and I didn't look back. It was amazing. I loved it.
what makes for the best and what makes for the toughest harvest? Like, you've done five, I think, at Kalu's. You've done one at Black Hills. Mm-hmm. What are the best and the toughest moments when you're out there?
Yeah, so I think the toughest is you're putting your whole life into these, like, 3-4 months of harvest. It takes a while for your family and friends to understand that I can't come to this. I can't do that. So you miss out on some things. And so that's tough because it's sometimes, you know, you go home and it's midnight and you have to go to bed. You wake up and you go back and you can't answer everyone's messages and stuff like that. That's the hardest for me. As far as like actual winemaking, I love the challenge of making wine. So I don't find too many challenges in that sense. And I find it rewarding, you know, when you finally get to finish a wine, you see it's dry, you put it into barrel, it's sulfured, and you stack it away. Mm-hmm. That's the best feeling.
Yeah.
You know that, like, okay, now it's safe and it's good to go. And you get excited for bottling that in the future.
One thing I love, like, you're so perfect with Kelly because your enthusiasm just talking about, and then it's sulfur, like you lit up. Mm-hmm. And there's times when I've interviewed her, Kelly twice, and I see the same thing, like just sort of the lighting up. All right, so some personal questions, but more on the fun level, or maybe I'll get serious and you can lie on the couch and we'll talk about it. When was the last time you really beat yourself up? Do your friends get intimidated if they bring wine to your place?
Oh my gosh, yes. Nobody wants to drink wine with me. Oh yeah, it's tough. And sometimes I go over to like my parents' friends' houses and they're like, I really love this wine, but it's okay if you don't like it. Yeah. And then they get all nervous. I'm like, yep. I'm just happy you're drinking wine, especially if it's an Ontario wine. I'm happy, you know? Yeah. But it, you know what's funny? It's the people that make their own wine that aren't nervous. Mm-hmm. And like their home wine brews, then people are like, try this. This is so good. And I'm like, oh
no,
boy.
No, it's not.
Oh boy. That's some tough. That's
you
tough
have
to go
too
down.
Much confidence.
Yes,
and
exactly.
You have not enough confidence.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh my gosh. It's so funny.
And then when you bring wine over, does everyone go, oh, look what, like Brooks.
Yeah.
And then they treat it, you know, that this is, you know, this is obviously going to be the nectar of the gods compared to whatever they brought.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, totally. People are really supportive of what I do. I'm really, I'm grateful for my family and my friends because they all support me and they get it and, and they like my wines. So that's good.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, you know, in the end, well, that, how good does that feel? How good does that feel when you pour a wine and maybe when you're not, when they don't know you're looking at them, but you can tell someone's enjoying a wine that your hands were a part of. That must feel great.
It's a great feeling. Yeah. I love when people come up to me and say like, oh, I love the 2018 Pinot Noir Reserve from Kalu's. I love that feeling. And I encourage everyone, if there is a winemaker around and you love their wine, tell them because, you know, sometimes we bottle and then we don't see that wine for like at least months and then it goes into the tasting room and sometimes you don't hear about it. And so getting that feedback is really rewarding because it's kind of like, okay, it's in bottle. Bye. It's like you send your kids to college and and you don't see them again. You know, they come for Thanksgiving and then that's it. So yeah, it feels really good and to get the feedback for sure.
How was it initially? Like you said, how much of an adjustment was it for your friends and family when you embarked on this journey?
I think everyone always says that they get it and then it's different than what it is. I'm lucky that my partner was in the wine industry for a while, so he gets it.
Right.
So I don't have any issues on that end, but I can't imagine, you know, going through that with someone who doesn't understand that because, you know, that person needs you too. And it's the same with family. I have a nephew who has a birthday during harvest and I try to, you know, do something special with him in August, but does he understand that, okay, you know, she's not at my birthday. And that was actually my birthday back then. So I think they definitely get it now. It's mostly my friends and stuff too. I wish that I could go to that Halloween party or whatever
right?
But it's, I can't, you know? Yeah.
And you know, it's funny, like my other job is I work in sports media and it's actually the same thing. When you talk to any athlete, you know, how many Christmases or Thanksgivings or parties did you miss? And, you know, cause you were on the road, you were training and you know, it's the same kind of thing. So then with that sacrifice, does it feel good? You've won a couple awards, the top 30 under 30 of hospitality in Canada, the Paul Pender Rising Star Award for the Ontario Wine Awards. You know, did those moments, did that help to make you at least go, okay, I didn't sleep much this week, but I'm trying to find the best way to put it, but
yeah.
How important was that validation?
It's incredible, especially as an assistant winemaker. I don't have the winemaker title. Mm-hmm. To get that kind of recognition at this stage in my career is huge. It feels really good. And sometimes I don't feel, you know, it feels like imposter syndrome sometimes,
right. Yeah.
Because it's what did I do to deserve this great honor in the Paul Pender Award? It's incredible. I'm so grateful. And I know for a fact that I work very hard and I do sacrifice a lot, but it's worth it. And it's because I love what I'm doing. And so to get the validation, it's like, I'm on the right path. I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing.
What does it mean to be an assistant winemaker?
Mm-hmm. The job of assistant winemaker is, it varies depending on where you're working. There's definitely different roles for the job. The way I see it is it's my job to make the winemaker's job easier. I don't come to the winemaker with problems. I come with solutions.
Right.
Hopefully I can give the winemaker a day off, you know, because they trust me and I can do the work. That's always been my goal and why I loved working with Kelly is because, you know, she doesn't get days off. She works. And I want her to be able to do more because that's what she wants to do. So it's my job to, at harvest, I set up the day. I make sure that, you know, if we're going to do a press out, what tank are we going into? Okay, we don't have any tanks. So what do we need to do to get a tank? I'm always thinking about what's coming the next day and the next day on the current day.
Right.
So that's my job, is just logistics and making Kelly's life easier.
How long did it take for her to trust you?
Oh, that's a good question.
So all the other questions were kind of crap, but this is the one. This was the one good one. All the other ones were, yeah.
It takes her a little bit, but I think that she trusted me probably starting fully, I would say by 2020,
so
2021.
Four years in?
Fully trust me where yeah. She can take a day off and knows that I'm
right.
I'm good.
Yeah.
I think she trusted me right away with my work ethic.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as taking some of the workload off of her, definitely by 2020.
So this quote from her talking about you, she helps keep us on track, ask tough questions, find solutions, and make sure the job gets done. And of that, the words that I was most interested in was asks tough questions. Yeah. What are tough questions?
So I would say asking the tough questions is maybe doing things that maybe isn't the easiest thing to do and saying, okay, is this what we should be doing? So that we can get further ahead rather than, you know, we could do that in a couple of days, but if we do it today, then we know it's done.
Mm-hmm.
And we're ahead of the game. And maybe it's some things for instance, for Kelly, the Mason Vineyard release, the first one, she was asking okay, well, I want to release on this day. And I know that bottle shock, so when you bottle a wine, it goes through a period of shock where it's, you know, it's a bit different. It's been roughed around.
Right.
She wants to get around that. She was like, I know I need at least 3 months of bottle shock before I can release, but she had kind of a timeline. So I guess a tough question would be, should we be bottling this by hand? And we did.
Mm-hmm.
And that way she could release earlier.
How lonely is it sometimes making wine? I think it was on your Instagram account. It was just you sitting there alone with some barrels. What was that picture? What was that moment?
So at K-Loose, we have usually 5 interns that work with us, and they're all incredible, hard workers always. And I become very close with them. I would call a lot of the past interns and current interns that we have my friends. December 15th, they're all gone. So it's just me and Kelly, and mm-hmm. we try at that time too to take some days off. So it's lonely sometimes, honestly, when you're in this big cellar all alone and you're topping the barrels. So And then, yeah, you go through a phase where you're like, oh, I just had like five people in here with me and now I have just,
yeah,
just me. So,
yeah. Are you playing music? Is it back to the one hit wonders?
Yeah.
Are you the top hits of the 90s, a little Natalie Imbruglia? Yeah. Like, what's going on there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. You got to have music. But the thing is, when you have music on, if someone comes in the door and you're alone, you don't hear them.
Right.
So often you get scared in the winery. People sneak up on you and it's...
Oh, that's mean.
Yeah. And you don't... Nobody means to. And sometimes you sneak up on someone. You're like, I don't want to scare you. And then they still freak out because it's like... You thought that you were totally alone in your zone. And
what's the collaboration wine series? Because obviously you work here at Domaine Queluz and you work with Kelly on her wines. And then there's the collab.
So the collab on Mason Vineyard, it is a chance for Kelly to work with other winemakers or different vineyards, something different that doesn't fit with her off her own vineyard wines. So... For the first collab, she chose to work with me, which kind of actually gave me my first like winemaker moment where we made all the decisions together. So we made a wild fermented rosé and a Viognier wild fermented. And that was really fun. It was cool because, you know, we work together all the time on the wines, but ultimately she gets the final say.
Right.
And on this, you know, we were really working together, and even the choosing of the grapes and the winemaking style, we were like totally collaborators.
So this is a point where I got to try to dig up dirt now that the power dynamic is a little bit different than what it would be at Queluz or at Mason Vineyard. Was there a moment of friction? Was there a moment where Kelly's like, here's how we're going to do it? You're like, let's step back for a second here. I think we should do it like this.
Yeah, I think for the most part, we do agree on things. I think where we're a little bit different is Kelly will tend to get a little bit more worried about things. Mm-hmm. And she's like, oh, the wild ferment's not going. And maybe that's from experience. I'm a little bit naive. I'm like, no, let's wait.
Yeah.
I don't want to do anything just yet. Like, let's just see how it goes. And so I think that's where we're good, is that like, I am a little bit more calm in making some of the decisions, whereas she's a little bit more worried, but she's usually right.
Yeah.
So that's the way it is for sure. But yeah, the wines we made were really cool. The rosé was fermented on skins. We pressed off it was a Gamay, a rosé, and we threw some whole clusters into the tank for a little bit of carbonic. And it made the wine really like full bodied for a rosé and made it really good with food. And what was interesting about that is that we didn't really plan for that. We were kind of like, this sounds cool, let's do that. And we even asked Shiraz, have you ever done this before? And he's like, no, I haven't. Oh. I wish I thought of that.
And so by the way, for people don't know, Shiraz winemaker at Malabar.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And so, yeah.
In the notes for the 2020 Wild Ferment Rosé, if you read the whole thing, which I did, it says, enjoy, this wine was a challenge. There was no follow-up there. What does that mean? What was the challenge with the 2020 Wild Ferment Rosé?
We do Wild Ferment for everything, so it's kind of our thing, and we think we know what we're doing, of course. But if we ever struggle with Wild Ferment, it's always the whites, because the reds have the skins, so it has a lot more going on there, and it can kick off the ferment no problem. I think we waited a little bit before the ferment started, and then it was slow to finish.
Right.
So it was one of those times where you're just like, you know, some winemakers say, oh, just wait for the full moon. And we're like, okay, the full moon's here and no ferment kicking off.
Wait for the full moon.
We're not quite on that end the crazy, wild ferment. But so it was kind of just, it just, you know, you lose sleep over, you know, is that wine okay?
And you have no control.
No control.
You just sit there. By the way, have you ever been tempted? Have you ever, like with someone who quits smoking and every now and then they're like, oh, just one drag, just one smoke. Do you ever go, you know what? Why don't we just get some commercial yeast in here? Let's make our lives easier. Yeah. We can binge watch a show, go out for the weekend. Let's get some commercial yeast.
Yeah. You know what? The first stage is just purchasing it and leaving it in the fridge.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just have it there just in case.
Yeah. It's just in case. And we've been pretty lucky. We like with the stuck ferments, like we're not usually needing to do it. But we usually, like, the first step is purchasing it and putting it in the fridge. We just know it's there.
Yeah.
If we need it, it's there. And then, yeah. But usually you just need to give it some heat and then it goes.
So the Viognier, I'm curious what the motivation. Was it just because you like it? Was it because you want to do something different? Or, you know, it's a good hipster wine.
Yeah.
Like, if you go out and people are like, oh, yeah, I love Chardonnay, I love Montrachet, I love Mosel Riesling. Oh, I prefer Ontario Viognier. That's kind of like, that's a great sentence to just up your wine hipster credibility.
Yeah. Yeah. So I would say kind of all of the above. Like, we were looking at Grimsby Hillside Vineyard, and we were looking at Chardonnay for Domaine Caylus. They were showing us the whole vineyard, beautiful property. And they said, oh, and that's Viognier over there. And Kelly and I just looked at each other. We're like, Viognier? Okay. And we just begged them. We're like, who's taking that? Can we please have some? We just want a ton, you know? Yeah. And they gave it to us. And we were just excited to work with something different. And honestly, because we do a lot of Chardonnay, it's so refreshing to taste something that's a little bit different in the cellar that's fermenting.
Yeah.
So to have an aromatic is like super exciting for us. I always get excited to try them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. You mentioned about like Grimsby Hillside. And this is, and for people that listen on a regular basis, I'm sorry, I'm going to go over some old ground, but I think it's always important to keep hammering it. The grapes that you guys source from, what are some of the vineyards out there?
So Grimsby Hillside, of course. We have a great property from Caylus that we started purchasing last year. It's the Julian Risto is the head guy there. Niagara-on-the-Lake, Cab Franc and Merlot, and it's fantastic. We have our own vineyard on Mountain View Road for Caylus, and that's Lincoln Lakeshore. And then we have Kelly's Vineyard as well.
Yeah.
So we get to put our hands in a lot of different locations, which we like.
And I know you always have to be careful about generalizations because there is no one sweeping flavor for Niagara-on-the-Lake versus the Bench.
Yeah.
But I'm just, for people out there, what do these different vineyards, what are the different characteristics? Like if you're going to be drinking a Pinot that's more Niagara-on-the-Lake versus one that's, you know, on the Bench, like what are some of the differences that you would find?
I think to put it in like as simple as I can,
yeah,
for Niagara-on-the-Lake, they're usually 2 weeks ahead in the growing process than we are, so they can get their bricks a little bit higher because it still rains on the same days. So if it rains here and we're at 19 bricks and the Pinot, maybe that's not great for the Pinot, but they're already at 21. Mm-hmm. Right.
By the way, sorry, just for people that don't know Brix, just if you just quickly go over that with them.
Yeah, sure. So Brix is the measurement of sugar in the wine, and that's how we can decide the ripeness. And every winemaker has a different Brix that they would want to pick at. You can also go based off of flavor, but typically you would want to have your wines at like 21.
Right. Yeah.
And
if it's too low, what happens?
So if you can't get your sugar levels up to, I think, 20 or 19.5 for Pinot, then you can't single vineyard that wine. So you do need to get a certain Brix level to achieve single vineyard status.
Yeah.
So that's important. That's important to us because we want to do that as much as possible. That's our thing.
Yeah, there's the expression of it. Okay, so sorry. I just wanted to, just for everyone listening, Brix level, sugar level, you need a certain level, a certain number to get the power that you need and be able to harvest it. All right, so some of the differences again between like Niagara-on-the-Lake versus Bench.
Yeah, so typically they can get their grapes a little bit riper, I would say, and they're hotter. We are closer to the escarpment here on the Bench, so the airflow and is a lot cooler coming off of the lake. So, and I think that Grimsby Hillside, it's actually the shortest distance from the lake to the escarpment. We're getting better acidity, I would say. Maybe not better, it depends on what you're looking for, of course, but higher acidity and hopefully you're getting the bricks up to like 21. And then in Niagara on the Lake, you might be able to get your bricks up to 24 a little easier than you can on the bench.
Right. So oftentimes just bigger, more ripe, more power down by Niagara versus here.
Yeah.
A little bit cooler.
Yeah. And then different soil as well. I'm not going to get too geeky about the soil, but it's different.
Yeah. We won't do 30 minutes on limestone.
Yeah.
I'm curious. I think it was on one of your Instagram posts. You could sort of just infer the amount of work that goes into it, and then people sometimes don't want to spend $35 on a bottle of Ontario wine. I'm wondering, is that going to change because of generations? Like, I think about this all the time. Just my parents and just older generation. I'm older than you, so like I'm a couple generations removed from yourself. But I do wonder if younger. It is about more local, and you know, you recognize if you buy local, that's just better for the environment. Mm-hmm. And I do wonder, will we get to a point where spending $40 on Chianti or $40 on an Ontario Cab Franc, if it's seen the same way?
I think my generation will be the ones to support local more and will spend more money on wine. Mm-hmm. The challenge is getting wine in the hands of people my age.
Right.
That's the challenge, because we can't afford anything.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But the weird thing about that mentality is we can't afford anything. So we're more likely to say, okay, well, whatever, I'm going to buy that $50, $100, whatever it is, because what are we saving for?
Right.
That's what it feels like, honestly.
Interesting.
That being said, we're more likely to buy seltzers and beer. Mm-hmm. Maybe not so much beer. Beer's kind of on the outs, I would say.
Okay, so we're going a different direction here.
Yeah.
And I feel so bad. I'm going to use you as the voice of all of young people.
Okay.
So I'm sorry to put you... So what is the spending habits? Because I got to tell you, I try these seltzers. It just tastes like fuzz.
Yeah.
Like it tastes like... You probably don't remember this. When a TV... You know, just do that. It'll be all that fuzzy thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's what seltzers taste like for me.
Mm-hmm. I think that it's just because that's easy right now. I think that... I do think there is always a transition from beer to wine in like your adult life. You're kind of like, okay, I gotta like grow up, you know? So I think that, I mean, seltzers are what they are. And we go through phases where it's like, okay, White Claw's the best. And then you hate White Claw and you never want to look at a black cherry White Claw ever again. And then you move on to the Cottage Springs or whatever it is. So when we're going to move to wine, I know that people my age are going to move to wine, and I think they are. And they appreciate local and they understand the importance. I don't think they're as likely to say, like, unless they're like, I'm having Italian food, I want an Italian wine.
Right.
That's common.
Yeah.
But I don't think that people my age are more likely to pick up a French wine rather than an Ontario wine. I think that they're maybe more comfortable seeing something. Oh, I've seen that around. I got to try that.
And I think, and by the way, yes, for the younger generation, we're not being able to feel like you can afford anything. I mean, we could do an hour on just on real estate.
Yeah.
By the way, I won't tell you what I paid for my condo back in 2004.
Oh, God.
But if I did, or no, even before that, like in 2002, you'd be really angry.
Yeah.
So we'll move on from that. I think the other thing, though, is that once the next generation, they love Pinot, but they don't want to spend $195 on a bottle of Premier Cru.
Yeah.
And then Kay Luce here it's like, what, 63 on the reserve? Well, but then you taste it and they're similar enough. And you know that the time and energy and passion that went into making the bottle of Pinot here is the exact same level of time and energy and passion in Beaune.
Yeah. I think...
At a third the price.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that people still find Ontario wine to be so expensive and they don't understand, because it's like, it's just Ontario. Why is it $50?
It's the word just.
Yeah.
I think I got more passionate about over the years once I started interviewing all you guys.
Mm-hmm.
When I started interviewing all the winemakers and I see the time and energy and I see Ann Sperling in the middle of the night on a Wednesday with a push broom because everything's got to be clean.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, no, that $50... It's low. There's not a lot of profit margin here on this wine.
Yeah. And I said earlier, we have a team of 5 interns plus myself and Kelly. So even just, we need all those people to make this wine, because it's totally hands on and we could be working on just process and just getting from the grapes from the bins that they come in to the tank could take us 8 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So that's for 7 people.
Yeah.
So if you just put that,
yeah,
you know, into the bottle, it's just, and then, yeah, I mean, I could go down the whole rabbit hole, but it's a long process, and it's 2 years of taking care of this wine and making it the best that it could be, showcasing the vineyard. And if we want good vineyards, that comes at a cost too. And that's more expensive, and that's what we want. So there's so much that goes into that wine to make it that price, and the margins aren't great. And if you're getting it from the LCBO, they're even worse. So yeah, you got to go into the wineries, talk to someone who knows what they're talking about. And at Caylus, we're so lucky. We have great, great tasting room staff
that know what
they're talking about.
Yeah, it's great here. The outdoor space in the summer. And right now, it feels like you're almost in a ski chalet.
Yeah,
it is,
yeah.
A bit of a ski chalet.
It's nice.
It.
Yeah. Yeah, it's cabin-y. And you learn about what it took to make that wine, and you will understand. Like, it's not as simple as maybe it seems. It's like, it's a labor of love. And yeah.
Yeah. The, where do you see yourself question? I mean, how different are you now than when you were finishing college? I mean, just your own knowledge.
Gosh, so different. I'm learning all the time, and I've been working with Kelly for 7 years now, and I'm learning all the time. I think that you're really limiting yourself as a winemaker, and especially an assistant winemaker, if you can't admit that you don't know everything. You really don't. You're learning all the time. I didn't know what the job was back then. You know, you see the winemaker and they're in their office and they're on the computer, and you're like wondering, what are they doing in there? You know, like, I'm the one making the wine. And yeah, it's like, no, not at all. Like, there's so much admin and work that is behind the scenes that you don't see. And it's so important. I'd like to say that obviously I want to be a winemaker someday, but I'm loving this right now.
Yeah.
Because I'm getting my hands dirty. I'm doing a little bit of both sides and I'm seeing it all. And it's a challenge. And the big difference between an assistant winemaker and a winemaker is that it's on the winemaker's shoulders if something goes wrong.
Right.
That's a lot of pressure and a lot of money riding on somebody. And that pressure, I have it, of course, because I take responsibility and I take great pride in what I do. But that's ultimately on Kelly at the end of the day. They don't look at me and say what went wrong here, right? So I want to be a winemaker someday. I love working at Caylus and I love working at Mason Vineyard. I'm so happy. So it's hard to say where do I want to be, because I wouldn't want to be somewhere that I'm not making the types of wines that I'm making right now. This is what I love to do.
People don't want to say, you know, and ask a question, so where do you want to be? And you're like, I'm here.
Yeah.
Because then it makes it seem like, oh, you mean you don't have any other dreams? No.
Yeah.
Both can be true. There'll be other dreams.
Yeah.
But being right here, right now is probably the perfect place for you. Because as you said, you've learned a ton and you're still going to be learning a ton more. And you're surrounded by talented, good people.
Yeah.
I got to say, not a bad work environment to be in.
Yeah. It's the best. I have zero complaints. So.
Well, no, you have complaints, you know, the sleep and nephew's birthday, but you know.
Yeah, I have a couple complaints,
yeah.
But for the most part, I'm pretty happy.
Yeah. You should be. It's a hell of an environment, and these are incredible wines. Mm-hmm. Is there a last question? Is there a bottle you're saving, either here or, you know, from somewhere around the world? Is there a wine you got, a hidden basement or something that you're excited to open at some point?
I have so much Caylus wine right now that I'm holding on to. Yeah. Caylus and Mason.
Or what's the old, like, is there an older vintage that you're going to like, nope, give it another couple of years? Or I guess just as someone who makes wine, that must be so fascinating, just going, I can't wait to see in 3 years what this is going to be.
Yeah. I think maybe because I'm so close to it, or maybe it's just cellar palate, it's the Caylus and Mason wines that I get excited to open.
Yeah. Your blood, sweat, and tears went into that.
Yeah, exactly. It's a different feeling. So it's mostly those that I really think about. Like, I'm excited to open like a Summis from Caylus that's from 17 or 16. And the Mason Vineyard Sparklings, I love holding on to Sparkling and seeing where that goes. And then Pinot too from Caylus. The Grom Reserves, those
Yep.
The shelf life on those is great. So
absolutely.
I get excited about it. That sounds so boring. I get so excited about Kalu's amazing.
No, but it's better honest answer than you could just lie and say, well, I've got a Lafite and a couple DRCs for later, you know, and you know, these are incredible wines. I have a whole bunch of them in my cellar as well. Mm-hmm. Brooke, really appreciate. I think I started to learn about you when I started doing my research to interview Kelly a couple of years ago. So you were kind of always sort of on the radar.
Yeah.
And I love your journey because there's a long one ahead of you. You've accomplished so much. The collab wines and stuff with Mason, with Kalu's, and just, you know, just getting yourself in this position. It's fantastic. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you so much. This is great.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Stitcher. No, Stitcher's not here anymore. I hate it. I got to do a new outro on Spotify and iTunes and Apple. Wherever you go, get your podcasts. Just thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.